Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
Hello, Joshua.
How are you, sir?
Great. How are you?
Not bad.
Hey, Justin's on too.
Hey, Justin. How you doing?
Doing wonderful.
Hey, guys. Rachel is here.
Oh, awesome. I didn't know Rachel was going to be on. Hi, Rachel.
Making an appearance. I like talking about myself in the third person.
Hey, that's cool. You know, we live in a state that's next to Kansas, and Bob Dole is from there, and he always talked about Bob Dole, even though he was Bob Dole. So we're used to that.
Nice. Bob Dole.
Now that you have Rachel there, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, my name is Josh Zeman. I am a documentary filmmaker. I did Cropsey. And then I met Rach, and we did together. It was going to be a TV show pilot that never happened.
Backdoor pilot.
And about called Killer Legends, about, you know, the intersection of true crime and urban legends and how it all started. Mm-hmm. Rachel?
Yeah, Rachel Mills. I met this guy like 4 years ago on that series, came on as a researcher actually.
Yeah.
And met families and just became integral, I think, in the story, that it just became natural for us to, like you did in Cropsey, to have a person to go along in the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So out of that, then fast forward 4 years, now we're doing, or we've just completed this other show, Killing Season.
There's
a lot of killing.
Yeah.
They're going to say Killer Legends or something.
Yeah.
Right. And
now your film Cropsey starts with an urban legend. Is this something that you heard about when you were young?
Yeah. I used to go into those buildings and have keg parties there. And, you know, we used to talk about Cropsey. And sometimes his name was Willie, but we talked all about them.
And you grew up there, right?
That was our hometown. And, you know, in the middle of this island, this very kind of suburban island, you know, everybody thinks that there's something evil going on in the woods, right? Especially when you come from the city. All these people, like I said before, who came from Brooklyn. You know, when you lived in Brooklyn and there was a vacant lot, nothing good ever happened in that vacant lot. You got beat up. There was a rape. Somebody, you know, a body was found. And suddenly all those people moved to Staten Island. And then there's all these vacant lots, this whole forest, you know. And so they always thought something bad happened in the forest. That's how city people think. But it actually turned out to be true, because in the middle of this forest, what's called the Greenbelt, are these networks of abandoned buildings. You had the Seaview, it was Seaview Homes, it was a tuberculosis ward. You had the Farm Colony, which was a poor farm, and then you had the Willowbrook Mental Institution. So in these, you know, in these forests were really all these old, decrepit old buildings which had all this bad history tied with it.
And do you know where the name Cropsey came from?
Yes, and we got a lot of people who were very angry with us that we did not delve more into the urban legend of where that urban legend came from. Everybody, I'm sorry that I did not do more urban legend, you know, digging on this. But Cropsey came from the sleepaway camps of upstate New York. It was a legend that had started around there. And the legend was pretty much always the same. It was a camper. It was typically somebody of a well repute, like a doctor or a judge whose name was Cropsey. And they would – there was like a camp nearby. And he was in a like a cabin with his newlywed wife, or typically his newborn child. And the campers burned down the cabin. The wife and child die, and Cropsey is disfigured and then goes after the campers with an axe.
Why the name Cropsey?
Why the name Cropsey?
Yeah.
Rach is asking why the name Cropsey. It's a very –
it's a common name in New York.
It's a common old name. So Cropsey was, for example, Jasper Cropsey, who was a famous painter. There was also a Judge Cropsey. It was a revolutionary name.
In Brooklyn too.
Right. That's where a lot of that came from. But then there's something about the name itself, crop, to cut. You know, and that's another way. And so that urban legend about that sleepaway camp came down to New York City. It worked its way down. And then we attached that to this escaped mental patient. Now, here's the other thing. Wherever you go and across the United States, there are urban legends about mental patients, mental hospitals, you know? And so it was like two different urban legends coming together with some real true crime kind of connected to it. So it was just like the perfect storm of realness.
Some people got upset because you had this connection between Cropsey and this man suspected to be a kidnapper named Andre Rand.
Yeah.
To me, it makes sense. It's just, and I'll make a reference here to the chupacabra, but the chupacabra, everyone would say, oh, it was this little alien creature and it would suck the blood out of goats. But eventually it turned into these coyotes with mange. And so they looked weird and they had these really pronounced canine teeth. So they looked frightening. But some people were upset by that, saying, oh, it can't be these coyotes. But here you have this urban legend that's frightening. And as you say, all over the country, we have these. But in this case, we actually have someone who is a boogeyman and is operating and taking children.
Yeah, it was the fact that the police could never catch him. Like, everybody was like, the police were like, yeah, Andre Rand, we interviewed that guy when Holly Ann Hughes got taken in 81. You know, he's a pedophile. We know it, you know, but they could never catch him because they couldn't find the body of the children he supposedly took. It's called at the time it was called corpus delicti, no body, no crime. And so, you know, back then the police had their hands tied. So what we think happened is that those in the know started to kind of spread this rumor. But you can't really tell a kid, hey, there's a pedophile in the woods, be careful. That doesn't really work. You know, kids like something a little bit better. And so if you're like, hey, there's an escaped mental patient who lives in the basement who's going to come snatch you, that works. That keeps you from going in there.
Maybe some truth in that, right?
I mean, well, that's the whole thing, because then when you saw this Geraldo footage, you were like, oh my God, you know, this place is a nightmare. So, you know, you see how these urban legends come. Now, what's very interesting, by the way, is that I don't know if you guys are familiar with The Burning.
No.
It's a horror film that features a camp caretaker named Cropsey. And this was a slasher film A lot of people know about it. Happened at the same time. Had this kind of – this is one that used the urban legend. And that that film was produced – and I think one was Harvey Weinstein, the guys who used to own Miramax. One of them produced it and the other ones directed it. And they got that case from their sleepaway – their Jewish sleepaway camp in upstate New York.
And then there was the movie Sleepaway Camp.
And that was the movie Sleepaway Camp, yeah.
And Friday the 13th, which are right. all kind of mixed in there.
But the interesting thing is that, you know, that's another retelling of that urban legend, the Cropsey urban legend.
So there's this connection, though, that you make in your film where Andre Rand is essentially the boogeyman come to life.
Yeah.
And I guess kind of take us through that. It what happened where you said, this is Cropsey?
Right. You know, as kids, I don't think we really made that connection until we got older, until we started to go back. And we're like, and I remember speaking with some friends, and I was like, hey, do you remember the guy who took Jennifer Schweiger? Was that – that was Cropsey, right? Did we call that guy that guy? You know what I'm saying? It's like the kids had their own version, and then the adults had their version. And only when I became an adult did I then – remember the kid version and then make that connection. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it was only when I was able to understand it as an adult that I really understood the machinations of what was really happening and what was going on and what the stories were. And then it was very interesting because I wanted to make a doc. I wanted to make Paradise Lost, you know, which was one of my favorite docs. You know, I wanted to make this kind of like case where it was like, would they really prove it? No. And it was obviously a lot of prejudice going in, and this guy probably, you know, maybe he did something, but he didn't really do everything. And I quickly found out that there's a reason why you don't have a lot of documentaries about criminal trials, is because in New York you can't bring a camera into the courtroom. And I was like, oh shit, what am I gonna do now? We went back out into the community. That's when we started to speak to all of those searchers, and we realized the case wasn't about the facts. It was about the fiction. It was about how a community creates a boogeyman. And also, remember, any community that deals with the death of its children, someone going in and taking its children, this kind of deadly Pied Piper, like that is the worst thing that can happen to any community. And so people do not know how to understand or rationalize the death of their children and somebody who would do that. So that's why suddenly it goes from there's a guy who's doing this to he's evil. It is the devil, satanic panic. Like you must prescribe something which is beyond human comprehension when it comes to killing children.
And that evil must be stopped.
Oh, yes. By any means necessary.
And in your film, you talk about how they don't really have a smoking gun here. They don't have the evidence they need to say, here is your killer. This is the one boogeyman who took your children.
It was a mystery that we wrestled with, which was the police had been over this 365 acres time and time again with dogs, with void detectors, with everything. And somehow, I think it was 8 or 9 weeks into the search, they suddenly find, I think it was like a pinky sticking up out of the ground. And at that point, a group of searchers suddenly find this spot. And there was some question about, you know, was she reburied or not? You know, was this a bunch of searchers had found her somewhere else and they were going to finally stop Andre Rand once and for all. And so they took the body and reburied it close to his campsite in an effort to make sure that this evil had been stopped forever.
Are you talking about Jennifer Schweiger?
Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Okay. She was 12 years old and she had Down syndrome. Now, it's interesting that her parents understood that she was just going for a walk.
Yeah.
Was this urban legend not powerful enough to keep parents from letting their children go too far off from them?
I think at that time, that was 87.
Right. It was later on. This is as late in the case as you can get, I suppose.
Yeah, this is late. So that's a good question. Like, had the urban legend taken in root enough by that point that parents would tell their kids? you know, that's hard to say. I don't quite remember. I mean, I knew it as a child, but I think I knew it as more of a Cropsey's going to get you with the axe than there really is a pedophile. And it was 87. It was a very trusting time. Jennifer had Down syndrome, but she was a very rambunctious child. She would go from house to house in the neighborhood, and people would give her food. You know, Down syndrome children, they like to eat, you know, and they like sweets. And so all her neighbors would give her food. And so she kind of, you know, wandered about. There was even some talk that she had gone – she had, quote, unquote, run away before, but that's not really what happened. But she got her little pocketbook and, you know, went to the pizza place up the street, up the block, you know, and got a piece of pizza. So – I don't think the urban legend was prevalent enough, and probably not in that household. But when the bloodhounds tracked her to Willowbrook, that like a couple hours later, I think that's when suddenly everybody was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, I wonder if her being so well liked by the neighborhood, by her neighbors, you know, her parents felt like she was being watched by many eyes.
I think so. You know, it's you know, when you have a special needs child, you know what I'm saying? It's like it takes a village, you know, and I think that everybody was looking out for her. I mean, I've interviewed and it's I can't tell you, man, it's heartbreaking. So here's the other part. And, you know, we like to add spirituality to these murders to give them some sort of, you know, understanding. But there's the idea that a Down syndrome child never has an ill will thought in their lives. Right. And so they're 100% pure innocence. And the fact that she was killed just made it that much worse. And I remember speaking to all these people who were her neighbors and interviewing them. And the minute I would just be like, tell me about Jennifer, they would just start bawling, you know, because it was like the whole community had failed, you know.
When I watch interviews with parents who have lost their children, including in your documentaries, it really hits home. It's very powerful, and you can't help but feel for them. They had the best intentions. They did care, and yet a monster still snatched their children.
It's totally true. You know, I'm a parent as well. The problem is this, I told a story about a very horrific case, about the worst case scenario. But you also understand that at the time, the truth is that there was this huge stranger danger hysteria running around, and kids weren't being taken by strangers. They were being molested by uncles and baseball coaches and priests and all those other things. So I do kind of feel bad that like I presented this very nightmare scenario, but at the same time, I also wanted the world to know that it wasn't this. The norm wasn't this. It was actually, you know, the monster's a lot closer than you think.
Yeah, I think that's what makes them so effective, is they earn your trust by being in your environment and you get used to them.
Well, and somebody asked, we post a picture of Andre getting arrested today on our page. And somebody said, what is this picture of? And I was like, oh, that's Andre. And that's a picture of him getting arrested. And then he gets charged and convicted of kidnapping and murder. And immediately people were like, no, he doesn't get convicted of murder, just kidnapping. And I'm like, jeez.
That's true. But it carries in murder, kidnapping in the first degree carries the same sentence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And he's never been charged with murder. He's only been charged with kidnapping. Never been convicted of murder. He's only been convicted of kidnapping.
Yeah, they charged him in one of the cases that I know of.
Yeah.
But the jury decided there wasn't enough there to convict him of that.
That's right. That picture is just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I didn't think he was competent enough to stand trial. And then they put him in the mental ward for a while, and then they charge him later with the kidnapping. Yeah. What did you think of that?
So here's an interesting thing. I mean, remember, this was in 1987. And I think our understanding of the mentally ill, I mean, first we saw how badly we understood the mentally ill in 1972 with Geraldo.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing how much we still don't know the mentally ill, at least in 87. I believe that he did in fact go into a catatonic state, but that's not something that you can prove. unless you like hooked him up like right at that moment to some sort of device. And so people didn't quite know whether he was faking or not. You know, was he crazy or crazy like a fox? Mm-hmm. The one thing I can tell you is that in speaking with him in the very little that we did, or speaking with his lawyers, when he is not in a catatonic state, you know, when he's not going through a, you know, a schizophrenia kind of break, he's wicked intelligent. He's a smart guy. He's a little on the spectrum, but, you know, he's a very smart guy. And so it's very hard when, you know, you're speaking with him and he's very lucid and, you know, all those things, to then go to that picture and to believe that somebody could – what theoretically happened to him is basically kind of what you see in the movies when they have that, you know, psychopathic break, if you will. You know, like just it gets all too much and suddenly the mind just kind of shuts off. That theoretically is what happens in this type of schizophrenia that I've been told that he has.
And I figured once he was not medicated, so therefore he's having an outbreak or having breakdowns and possibly doing these horrible things, kidnapping people, and then they give him treatment. And then once he's better, then he stands trial. And I thought, well, how is – if he's not, you know, fit to stand trial at that time, then –
right.
Is he really accountable for his actions?
That's a good question. I think it was this. It was that, and I think this happens with a lot of criminals, especially pedophiles, especially people, rapists, people who kind of like react. So basically at the time he was getting into, I think he had like, we didn't include this in the film, but he had a girlfriend and he broke up with her, and some of the brothers were going to beat him up or something like that. He was having some sort of stressor in his life, and I think that caused him to react. In a rapist, that would be rape. In a pedophile, that would be kind of going and snatching a child. He then snatches the child, and the idea is that the reality of his crimes a couple days later, or when the police pick him up and they say, you did this, you know, kind of pounding him in the interrogation room, that's when the break happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely.
So that shot of him drooling is basically when they brought him into the Holiday Inn in Staten Island. They showed him the tape of Willowbrook, and that's when, you know, they confronted him with the grave necessity of his misdeeds. He then snapped. And at that point, they were like, well, now we're charging him. You know what I'm saying? And so then they did the perp walk, and that's when we see him drooling.
Mm-hmm. In the 80s, there was the residuals of the Satanic Panic.
Mm.
And I remember from your documentary, you talk about satanic cults, and people are talking about these cults abducting children. They also mm-hmm. say that he might have had somebody helping him hide the children in tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unlike the McMartin case, there were actual tunnels in this town, right? Where they could have put people, but they never proved or had anything to say that.
You know, that was the crazy thing about the McMartin trials, right? Levels and levels of dungeons and things like that underneath a preschool in Southern California.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Or witches riding broomsticks. So, but in this case, you're absolutely correct. And so I think in much like the case itself, you had kind of urban legend type details, hysteria type details that had some truth. And so it only allowed the kind of pitchfork public to go even crazier. And yes, so many institutions built at that time have tunnels. They did it basically so that they could move patients and children around without having to shovel, because that, you know, when you have a big facility, it costs a lot of money to shovel. And so when it snowed, they could lead the kids downstairs through the tunnel and back to another building. Also without losing them, you know what I'm saying? That the patients or the kids, they would, you know, a lot of them like to, you know, take off their clothes, remember, and they would wander around. And so it was a way to control them, and also a way that one staff member could control them. You know what I'm saying? Remember, the idea is that you had one staff member for like 30 profoundly developmentally disabled children, which is crazy. considering everything that they were doing. Now, when we spoke to the searchers who went down in the tunnels, they were looking for Jennifer, and they would find these old kind of child paintings on the wall that you actually see in the Geraldo footage, and it would say, "Did you stop and count the children?" And this was like the worst line that you could ever have. It was like out of a horror movie, right?
Yeah.
So then they just started to really just freak the hell out, you know? But these tunnels were real, and these are the same tunnels, and this is the same idea that you have in colleges across all the United States. Remember when the Dungeons and Dragons thing was going down? Mm-hmm. You know, that the kids would go into tunnels and do it. And, you know, a lot of colleges do have tunnels. A lot of mental institutions do have tunnels. A lot of old institutions do have tunnels beneath them.
Do you think that he was working in with anyone else? Do you even think he's actually guilty?
That's a good question. I think he did something, but I don't think he did everything. I think that there were a lot of patients who did return to the facility after it closed because that was where they spent their whole lives. That was where their parents were encouraged to drop them off and to never return. You know, and that is thanks to Reaganomics, what we did, and deinstitutionalization at that time. We took a busload of people and we dropped them off in the middle of New York City without any follow-up. That is one way in which we had the homeless issue in New York City and in a lot of other places, and why a lot of that homelessness, you know, dovetailed with the mentally ill. A lot of people did return. And I think Andre Rand, as you see, as someone says, he's like an evil, like Jim Jones. You know, you had a lot of very, I don't want to say gullible, naive, you know, people who were maybe interested in their own sexuality at the time. And I think Rand was somebody who manipulated those individuals into helping him do what he needed to do. I don't think it was crazy Machiavellian, if that makes any sense. I think it was just kind of twisted. And sometimes a little bit tragic. And so I do think he had some sort of help. The searchers and the public were like, Jennifer is being held against her will and she's being raced through the tunnels as searchers would go to one area, you know, a collective of mentally disabled people, you know, who are helping Rand's kind of ship of fools would bring him to the next area. Like, I don't think that was happening. At the same time, this was in 1987. All those people in Staten Island had come from Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, 7 years earlier, was Son of Sam. And Son of Sam had a lot of satanic goings-on in the back behind it. And so I think we were seeing a lot of kind of hysteria off Son of Sam. But one thing I will tell you is that Son of Sam really did have a satanic component to it, whether it was real, you know, or whether it was people, you know, doing a lot of bad deeds and then, you know, and using religion like so many people do, you know, to get it done, you know, to sell drugs or sell children and say it was, oh, it's all, you know, for the devil.
To justify it.
Exactly. Like, what better way you're going to get people to do anything? So that shaded this case. And if you've ever read Maury Terry's The Ultimate Evil, you will kind of see how that shaded this case. But there was some truth to that in this case. You had, yes, satanic panic. You had guys like Geraldo who were spewing the most ridiculous satanic panic you could ever believe. But you also had cops who did believe that something really was going down. Not the cops that you see in the film. Oh, actually it was. So, you know, the guy with the really long face, the guy dressed in black, the guy who talks about some people like to, you know, worship the devil. He worked on the Eton Pates case, and he worked a little bit in a lot of other child pedophile cases where you were getting a little bit of like these kind of like fake devil worshipers who were using the devil to like go around and snatch kids.
Well, unlike the Cropsey case in this new show you're doing, you know, where children are you have to be the most evil person to go after children, and we must stop this threat. In your new TV miniseries, the victims are almost ignored.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to talk about your new show.
So this is a docuseries that an 8-part docuseries, which is premiering on A&E November 12th, which is a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to do another serial murder case.
Why was that?
Because Cropsey was just too much. I wanted when I was done with Cropsey, everybody's like, oh, dude, you should totally do another serial killer movie, or you should do like a fiction. And I was like, it was interesting. I was like, you have no idea what murder is really like. And I was like, you go talk to a parent who's lost their child, who's then spent, you know, 40 years of their life replaying that those moments over and over again. And I was like, you have no idea. Yeah. And then this case happened.
Long Island.
Yeah. And I'll just quick rundown. In 2010, 4 bodies were found along a desolate highway in Long Island, New York. 4 bodies about 500 feet apart, wrapped in burlap, and they were all Craigslist sex workers. Over the course of another couple of months, the police ended up uncovering the remains of 10 more sex workers related to sex work. Six more, yeah. Leading to 10 bodies that were found along this highway. I thought it was going to get solved pretty quickly. I didn't think we could live in a day and age in which you can find 10 bodies and people you wouldn't find who did it. And that didn't happen. Basically, year one, no arrests. Year two, no arrests. And suddenly I was like, wait a second, what's going on here? It's time to pick up a camera, because now this was an opportunity for us to show what serial murder is really like, to go behind the headlines and to show how these investigations are so difficult, and to kind of show all those people who are watching Hannibal and all that other stuff that, like, serial murder isn't
– it's not sexy.
No, it's not titillating. It's really – more horrific than you can ever understand. And that's, you know, that's something like we tried to do with Cropsey, with the Geraldo stuff. Like, you have no idea how horrific it is until you watch this Geraldo footage. And that was the same thing we had here. You have no idea how bad it is out there until you really look at these cases.
Yeah. And I think, so Josh had started shooting what ended up being the Killing Season while we were in production for Killer Legends. He'd go off on the weekend and tell me, oh, I just, you know, drove a prostitute around Long Island and took her from, you know, job to job, essentially. Yeah. He would tell me, interviewed the author, Bob Kolker of Lost Girls. Great novel, great book, not a novel, nonfiction. So, you know, essentially it was going to be a self-contained feature documentary, much in the same vein as Cropsey, I would assume.
Yeah.
But it became very apparent to us very quickly that Long Island wasn't contained, that this was actually happening in so many places across the country.
Yeah.
And of course, the crimes were being approached in the same manner, it seemed, across the country.
Yeah. From the law enforcement perspective or from the crimes themselves?
It seems to be very similar across the board. And I think it's because we can look at different aspects of culture, and generally you'll find people have very similar reactions to things. So if you say someone was a sex worker, most people will look at that with disdain. And I think we might find that with law enforcement as well. I'm not saying that all law enforcement would feel that way. It just seems like they have to have priorities. They only have so much in their budget. They only have so many officers, so many detectives. And where are they going to put those people?
That's very true. I mean, look, you know, these women make it their jobs to evade law enforcement. That's what their point is. You know what I'm saying? You're doing something illegal. I don't want to re-blame the victim here, but I'm just, the reality is that when you're a sex worker and sex work is illegal, you are going to,
the byproduct is that you create yourself as the perfect victim.
Right. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And so when suddenly they find these bodies, there's, you know, it's not very trackable. You know, they try and hide from law enforcement. So immediately you are at a disadvantage in terms of trying to solve this crime as an investigator. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know where they were. You don't know who the last person was. But then there's something interesting as well, which is the internet has changed prostitution as we know it. No longer are some women walking the streets, and instead they're just snapping a selfie and going to meet someone up at the Holiday Inn up the street. And there's the idea that somehow, because the deal was initiated off Backpage, that there's some kind of paper trail, you know, electronic paper trail somewhere. But in fact, that's not the case, and the internet makes it a lot more anonymous. You're not leaning in to the car and looking at the guy mm-hmm. who you're about to go off with and kind of making that, you know, the sex workers tell us that they lean in and they make that decision right there and then using their spidey sense, you know, is this guy a killer or not? They don't have that when you make the deal over the phone and then you show up and the door opens and you step in the door, you know, and that's where you get your first look. You're already inside.
Well, unless the law enforcement can access their email and see what the, you know, John was emailing them, where they were going to meet.
I think, yeah, I mean, that brings up a great point. And that's what I thought going into this, like everyone's trackable, right? I'm on Facebook and I check into some restaurant. But as Josh said, like, they are all trying to evade law enforcement. They have burner cell phones. They deal in cash transactions. You know, they are, and these killers know that. You know, they're no longer going for runaways or hitchhikers or sorority girls. You know, we live in a trackable society. So they're going to go to the people who are evading law enforcement themselves.
Yeah, so they're not emailing back.
Yeah.
They're just calling off a number that's on the advertisement.
But I think also, like, we do live in a society where it feels like if you are functioning transactions on the internet, there's this inherent feeling that there's a vetting system there, which is absolutely true in a lot of respects, you know, but not when you're dealing with Backpage, not when you're dealing with Craigslist.
And these are the more independent women. They don't have, say, a pimp looking out for them or some kind of a bodyguard. I mean, some of them claim to have that, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
That's a really good question. I think definitely a lot of them are definitely independent. And I think that, you know, their drivers these days are what are their quote-unquote pimps or their quote-unquote bodyguards, but you know, they really aren't safe. And I think that, you know, we talked to Super, who you see in the first episode, and this isn't included in this series, but I know I had a conversation with her and she said that she's seeing a lot of younger girls, a lot more naive girls who are getting into the business. And I think that's because they feel that social media, being online, like there's this safety net that feels like it's there. And it's extremely easy to take a photo, post it on Backpage, and instantly you're getting inundated with calls.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing. That was one of the interesting things for me, how the sex work had changed. There was no more pimps anymore. There were like drivers, mm-hmm. you know, and the guys were like half liable.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but like one of the first interviews I did was with this sex worker, and I was driving her around up and down the Long Island Expressway, going to all these like Holiday Inns and Hampton Inns. And I was just like, there's this crazy underground society happening here in the most suburban place in America. Like Long Island is where Levittown started, the first suburban community. And so it was just so amazing to me that this girl was out there, and I was like, there's an active serial killer who is out there killing prostitutes, sex workers. Mm. Aren't you worried? And she's like, no, I'm not worried. But like, you could tell she was worried, you know, because any client, her next client could be her last.
Yeah. And this is the thing about the budgets and where to put their resources. If you have victims who are evading law enforcement and aren't leaving a very good trail at all, that just makes it that much more difficult. So why put resources into this? Is that the real sense here, that these people aren't being reported as missing. The families aren't as concerned. Now, I know you've interviewed families and they are concerned, but standpoint.
That's very much what it is. I think a lot of it is the families. If the moms don't scream and yell, nobody's going to come look for those women. You know what I'm saying? And so the perception is they're sex workers. You know, I think law enforcement, that does give law enforcement a good, like, it's more like, oh my God, you know, how am I supposed to go find this girl? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is impossible, you know? So I think it, maybe it's not so blatant, you know, although it used to be. There used to be a term that police had for crimes against sex workers. Like if a sex worker got raped or if she got beaten up, it, they would call it in on the radio. It was called no humans involved. And that was a term that had been documented in like San Diego in like the 1970s. And so sex worker murders were always no humans involved. But I don't think police are that bad, you know, anymore. I don't, I think that stigma is not as bad, but
no, well, what I was going to say is that I think it's difficult for law enforcement. I mean, we don't want to throw law enforcement under the bus in this series. You know, they could definitely do a lot of things better. But I also definitely understand the fatigue that they probably experience with a lot of missing persons, a lot of transient communities, people who go missing quite often and then pop up, you know. But for every person who goes missing and pops up, you know, every 50th person, actually, you know, something was really bad. Something bad happened to them. But how are you going to know?
Yeah.
You know?
But then again, the other thing that we uncover is that an inordinate amount of law enforcement agencies that had unsolved serial sex worker murders were also under investigation by the Department of Justice for civil rights violations. So basically you have law enforcement agencies that for some reason don't do very well in terms of community policing. And the question is, does that somehow allow killers to maybe feel like they can get away with it? And I think that was a little bit of what we were seeing.
Well, when you have soft targets, when you have an area, whether it be the, you know, an internet website or, you know, a neighborhood that, you know, there isn't a police presence, you know, there isn't going to be anyone trying to stop you, the bad guys kind of start to float in that direction. Do they?
Totally. That's totally what we saw. Cleveland, Albuquerque, you know, and numerous different places.
And I wonder too, if you brought up Albuquerque, there are certain places in the country where corruption is more prevalent. And I wonder if, you know, say some communities in around the country, maybe, and I'm just throwing this out there, but maybe Minneapolis perhaps fares better when it comes to tackling crimes like this than, say, Albuquerque.
Yeah, like, you know, San Diego is really good at solving their crimes. Places like Detroit, Baltimore, Albuquerque, you know, so we met some great law enforcement agencies. Daytona, the police chief. Previous police chief there was unbelievable, very transparent, but we met some unbelievably non-transparent law enforcement agencies, and crime begets crime. It was shocking how much corruption had seeped into the Albuquerque Police Department and how that filtered down into these communities. And, you know, it's really a shame.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
You had spoken to one police officer who had a very questionable tactic of trying to scare the women off the streets. Were you able to confirm that they were actually using that tactic, or was it just something he said?
We were never able to confirm that. That was in Albuquerque. I would not say that was out of the realm of possibility. There.
You believed him.
I kind of did believe him. I think he was actually truthful. I think that he was working Vice.
Right. Who would make that up?
Well, he was like down on the streets. When you're Vice, you know, you're dealing with but I totally believed him. I thought that he thought that he was doing the right thing. Even though I'm not going to say it.
What? Well, and that cop, by the way, like, people are convinced he was the killer.
Yeah.
They are convinced.
To this day, yeah.
Still.
But the real question that I have on this is, so there's this comment that's supposedly made, which is, we're going to kill you. I mean, how does that help these women that are out there if they would need assistance? They're not going to the police now.
Yeah, you're saying, like, if this cop is saying, if I see you back out on the street, I'm gonna kill you,
because
you know we're killing girls,
right?
You know,
right. Yeah, no, that doesn't work. I mean, they're trying to scare them from, like, staying on the streets no matter what. But you know, most of these women have substance abuse problems. Right, they're so gonna go to the street. You know, you're gonna go to the street,
and they're making too much money.
Yeah. Right. So all you've done is basically, like, prevent them from coming to you when something really does. Listen, that was one of the more crazy police tactics we had ever heard. But, you know, it was so outlandish to say.
We were shocked that we heard that.
To say we are killing – we told these women that we were killing them in an effort to take them off, keep them off the streets. I mean, it was crazy. But there was a certain logic to it. There's a certain street logic to it, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was only that one officer – no one else was using this tactic as far as you were aware.
Well, I would not be surprised if people in other cities use that tactic. I'm sure it's like, yeah, it's Vice. I mean, I'm sure they share their, you know, tactics. There's probably some subreddit forum like Vice tactics, hashtag Vice tactics. I don't know.
I tell the girls we kill them.
Crazy. Something that you guys confront murderers and suspected murderers. And from episode one, I was screaming at the screen, why don't you have a security, you know, detail with you? And then later on, you do. What changed that prompted that?
It's a lot of insurance issues with the network who requires us to have.
The network made us carry around bulletproof vests with us everywhere we went. We never wore them.
They just stayed in the back of the production van.
I'm like, do we really have to carry around 8 bulletproof vests? I was like, if we're going to die, we're going to die. So let's just do this. I guess when we were in Long Island closer to home, I think we felt a little bit safer just because we were in New York in our own element. Yeah. But when we started to hit places like the deep woods of Florida in, like, full-on True Detective land –
Yeah.
Suddenly, you felt like you know, that guy that we interview.
Buff. Oh, well, I was going to say we had Buff with us.
Yeah, we had Buff with us. Well, we went – that was because we went to the
– Yeah.
To a certain motorcycle gang, which we will not say publicly, who is known for literally killing and beating people. And we were like knocking on the door of that – of that motorcycle club. Like, that is a stupidly dangerous thing to do. But it was, you know, we just thought it was so crazy it just might work. Now, the other thing is remember in that episode, guys, you know, you see us talk to that one guy who lived on that farm?
No, it wasn't a farm. It was a
swampy compound.
Yeah, compound.
That there's two bodies on that on those grounds. There are two bodies.
And in that area, there was only one way in and one way out.
Yeah.
Oh, tell him the sound on his phone.
Oh, that we couldn't show up. It was like in the middle of
walking up.
Yeah, as we were walking up, suddenly the guy's phone rings. I guess they were warning him that we were coming. You hear House of the Rising Sun. You know, just about
which you couldn't clear.
Which is about prostitution. We're like, oh, we're in the right place. But that was a particularly scary interview as well, because that was a bad scenario. That was a really bad scenario. I believe that there are two bodies on those grounds.
This goes back to you were saying that you really didn't want to cover serial killers again. And I thought to myself, well, it's not about your comfort level. You're thinking, we need to do this. And it led you to communicating with biker gangs. And to me, that it really brought some sort of fear to the episodes, because I can't imagine trying to set up a meeting with people like this who are pretty ruthless. I can see it on your faces. I can feel it through the screen when you guys are attempting to set this stuff up. You realize the kind of risks that you're taking.
Mm. The motorcycle gang was pretty hairy. Mm. I was...
Daytona in general was pretty hairy.
I mean, there was look, we weren't doing it for like ratings or anything like that. You know what I'm saying? It was like, if you want answers as to who is killing women in the community, that's where you go to get these answers. You know, crime begets crime. Like, bad guys mix with bad guys. We found that when we were having a conversation with this guy, you know, John Robert Williams, who was in jail. You know, he told us, oh, I had a network of seven other people, you know, five other people, and we would trade women back and forth. You know what I'm saying? So, again, you know, if you want answers, that's where you have to go and get it. And I think we always felt like we may be able to solve the crime if we just went far enough.
Yeah, and I think just to piggyback on that, is that we didn't want this series to be sanitized. You know, we wanted it to be real. Like, what you see is what you get in this series.
Yeah, there's no script or anything like that.
It felt very raw. It was one of the rawest, like, grittiest things I've watched in a while.
Oh, that's good.
Good. I'm glad that came across.
Well, that's the whole thing. Like, that, you know, it's not like Hannibal. It's not like... What's that show, The Fall?
The Fall.
Where it's like a really good-looking serial.
Hot.
Yeah, really good-looking serial killer, you know, and it's like a female investigator, and they're like kind of playing cat and mouse, and it's kind of slightly titillating. Yeah, you know, it's like, no, it's not like that.
No.
You know, if you want to know what it's really like, this is what it's really like, you know?
And that's something that came across, was that some of these murders may have been committed by people where other people had knowledge of those murders, knew who the killer was. And it was just a matter of, would they ever talk? Would they ever release that information?
Yeah. It's frustrating.
Hmm. Is there, just a question for you, is there a specific case that you think there are people who know more information who aren't coming forward?
Well, I guess one of the things that really struck me during the series was, at some point, because you start with the Long Island serial killer case, but you stretch out from there, and there are all these murders happening to prostitutes, and you discover that, wait a minute, the best way to commit these murders and to get away with it is to be a truck driver. And because you don't have, they can't just go to your home and search it. These people can pick up a woman and drive across the state line and throw her off, you know, the side of a highway. And no one has any idea how she got there. And where's your crime scene at? Now, I spoke with someone I know who was a truck driver for 34 years. And he said back in 1992, he had a conversation with his nephew, who was a police officer, and said, you know, if you're looking for a connection, you can just get on your CB radio and ask, and people will contact you back. And his nephew was saying, I don't know if I believe that. Well, sure enough, he had him get on the CB radio. This woman said, I'm a lonely housewife. Where are you at? And she showed up in minutes to this truck, this rest stop. And of course, they gave her the wrong description of the truck. And here she comes driving up, and she goes up to a different truck and is knocking on the door. And luckily, the man wasn't there. He must have been in eating or using the restroom. And they said she slowly drove around and then finally left. But all he had to say on the CB radio was, are there any lonely women out there?
Yeah. Commercial traffic.
Commercial traffic, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking for some commercial traffic.
But the interesting thing there is that it's not happening so much on the CB radio anymore. It's actually happening on Backpage and Craigslist with the, like, Motel 6s that are right next to. Yeah.
Right, so, right. Well, it's become more sophisticated due to the internet.
Yeah. So now, like, it's happening on computers in the trucks with Wi-Fi.
Yes.
You know? And so that was crazy. But, yeah, the trucker thing takes it to a whole new level of fear, of seediness, of grittiness. It's tough. I mean, you know, picking a woman up, killing her and dropping her four states away, and nobody knows who the hell she is because she doesn't have any ID on her, and like, how long is it going to take to connect that murder back? That was where it's one thing for that to happen, but you're like, okay, well, once she gets into the morgue, we're going to figure that out. And then you realize, what? These databases aren't connected? What? Somebody's using a Mac and another person is using a PC, and that's why we can't connect a name to a face? Are you kidding me? It's that bad out there? And then we interview, you know, the head of the VICAP program, and he's like, oh, yeah, we don't connect half the cases that we should.
Mm. Yeah, it's a scary thought that a woman abducted in Texas can be dropped off in Colorado, and they, you know, Colorado authorities find the body, but they have no idea who she is. They're checking their missing persons cases.
Yeah.
They don't know which state to look in. I mean, the number of missing people in this country, it's so vast, it's so large that there's no way. I'm surprised they can identify as many people as they do, which brings me to another question, which is, when we do research on cases, I often go out to web sleuths just to kind of get a gauge on what people are discussing, what's important to them, what their thoughts are, what their takes on different evidence or people, you know, suspects are. And you have web sleuths all over this series.
Mm-hmm.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
The one guy, what's his name? Peter Brandt?
Brent.
Peter Brandt, yeah, he's pretty amazing.
Oh, that guy's a character.
Yeah. But, you know, so before I started with Peter, I'm like, all right, you know, he's like, yeah, you know, it's the police. They don't know anything. Nobody knows anything. You know, I'm a you know, profile. And he was saying some smart stuff. I gave him the case files for Cropsey as a test. And they were pretty good. He did a really pretty good job.
Oh, he's also in Killer Legends, yeah, makes a guest appearance.
Right. And so I was impressed, you know. But, you know, what was nice is like you're getting somebody who also understands, who can give you the real deal on law enforcement. And then you guys got guys like Carl Kay, you know, who are matching names to faces. You know, this guy is doing what the police can't do because, let's face it, who has time to, you know, go through all those, to do the facial reconstructions, you know, to look at all, you know, police records from the 1950s. But the thing is that he's finding a lot of serial murder connections. He's identifying a lot of victims from serial murderers. You know what I'm saying? So he actually could end up really breaking the case. But that was what was so surprising to me, that, yes, there's a ton of crazy people out there, as you know. You do the same thing. But every now and then you find somebody and you're like, oh, that guy's on the ball.
So you say in the series, this series that's upcoming, about how many discoveries that Web Sleuths has made. It's like a community of armchair detectives, and they're all working very hard. Do you know, when they make some sort of discovery, how does it get pushed up and sent out as a result?
Well,
because there, you know, there are thousands of posts.
Yeah, or, yeah,
not even thousands. There are millions.
Yeah. When they do make a connection, it's pretty well documented, you know. And a lot of it's a lot of hard things to measure. Like, I think that there's a lot of probably clues that people are talking about that just don't get picked up for whatever reason. The only way to quantifiably measure results is typically with the missing and unidentified when they do that. The problem is that law enforcement agencies just don't take them seriously. So a lot of their work falls into, you know, the netherworld of, like, you know, they call the missing persons typically like the bunker squad. Like, a lot of people who get sent down in missing persons are like cops who are being punished. So,
well, and I also think, like, yes, I totally agree with missing persons and unidentified remains and making those connections. But I also think that law enforcement is slowly being more open to this kind of crowd-solving community. You know, we often talk about this case of the T-shirt.
Yeah, the T-shirt.
Yeah,
in
the T-shirt.
Mexico.
No, I think it was in Utah. Right. This unidentified remains. This John Doe who was wearing this T-shirt, and there was like a little bit of like some kind of drawing on there, and they didn't know who this was for like 30 years, and for whatever reason, the police chief released a picture to Web Sleuths. And within, I think it was 24 hours, they had figured out what the T-shirt was.
What the logo was,
where it was sold. I'm not quite sure if the case has been solved, if they've identified it. But to actually, like, identify a piece of clothing and to be able to track that, that's a huge break in a case.
So what we found... Yeah, it's crowdsourced. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we all know that the power's out there, right? Because we see it. Like, geez, look at, you know, crowdfunding. You know what I'm saying? Like, so we all know the power's out there, but law enforcement just doesn't have the wherewithal, you know, maybe a little bit of ego or, like, even the services to go in and be like, okay, gang. You know, but that's really how it should work. It should be that there's, like, somebody who releases to this community a piece of information that they know is just going to be, like, they're going to have to stay up hours to figure it out. And then they send that piece of information out, whether it's a missing person. Like, that's exactly what I would do. If I was law enforcement, I would send the picture, a missing person, to be like, okay, guys, you know, all okay, junior detectives, you know, we've got this missing person. Everybody out there, go try and find out who it is. You know, and if you can harness that power, then you could solve a ton more cases.
And I really do feel like that's where we are going. I mean, I quite often say that law enforcement is still pretty much of a good old boys club, which is totally understandable. And as new millennials come into the force and understand social media and the power of crowdsourcing, I do feel like we're going to be able to turn to them help.
That'll change.
Legitimately.
Yeah. But again, the public sector is always behind the private sector when it comes to that stuff.
Right. But the potential is there, and we've already seen results. And so there has to be some sort of a trust, I suppose, or a new approach taken, because, you know, they don't have to do it in every case. But when you have these cold cases, or you have cases that just seem like you've hit a wall and they're relatively new, whether it's old, new, just send it over to Web Sleuths. Some of the people that are there are obviously very good at what they do, and it seems a waste to not utilize those resources.
Well, it's like the ultimate tips hotline.
Totally, right? You know,
that may be the best way to approach it, to get law enforcement to see the usefulness of this.
I really wish I wish somebody would give us that opportunity. I wish we could see, like, okay, guys, give us your cases. Give us a little bit of information. Because a lot of times the reason why these missing and unidentified don't get identified is because somebody put in a wrong piece of information in, like, 1986. Like, some cop has been working 15 hours and he's, like, hunting and pecking on the keys, and he puts in 6'2" instead of 4'2". You know what I'm saying? And everybody's like, it couldn't be this person. This person's 6'2", you know? So it's like, oh, that's how these mistakes get made. That's why these people don't get connected. And so if you can go back, like, that would be the coolest thing in the world. Like, to go to police departments and be like, give me your cold cases. Give me something that that doesn't quite work, and let me go to town with a bunch of web sleuthers. The problem is law enforcement agencies are so territorial, they won't even talk to each other. Much less citizens.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why the action card that we have at the end of every episode, it doesn't have just the 1-800 tips or the local 800 number to give, you know, tips to. It actually directs people to websleuths.com as well.
Yeah.
And I hope that that generates a new audience and new, hopefully, quote, armchair detectives.
Totally.
One observation when you were talking about a cop misinputting something, I did a police ride along with our local police department, and I was watching him fill out a police report about a gun that he found. And it wasn't like he, you know, got it off a person. It was on the street just laying there. And he's typing into an AS-400 type interface, and the gun models and manufacturers are not in alphabetical order. He had to scroll through all of the makes and models.
Ugh. Somebody has to get these guys better user interface. You know what I'm saying? Like, if Apple put as much work in, you know, their operating systems. Well, that's the thing that we say. Like, it's unbelievable in terms of the algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Basically, Netflix has a better algorithm than the United States of America in terms of having to try and solve its murders. You know what I'm saying? Like, we pick better movies than we do find killers.
And you interviewed the guy, what was it, the Murder Accountability Project? On
yeah,
the show.
Thomas Hargrove. Crazy. Yeah. How is it that we do not have one database in the United States that is mandated where all the law enforcement agencies have to put in their murder data? It's crazy to me that one citizen could have the most robust database of murder in the United States. And I tell people this. I was like, do you know that police aren't required to send in their murder data to the FBI? And they're like, what? No, that can't be true. I'm like, it's totally true.
So would this take some sort of federal action to make that work?
Good luck.
It's a good question.
Well, I'm just saying, if we were going to solve that issue, it would take something at the highest form of government to make it happen.
Rach has really done a lot of the work in trying to figure out how to make that happen.
Yeah, so you see Greg Cooper, who Josh was talking about, I think, earlier, who was the head of VICAP for a while, who really understands the limitations of VICAP and understands it's a broken system. And he has he's retired now and has an organization called the Cold Case Foundation. And they're really trying to figure out, while working with the federal government, how they can make the VICAP database better, how we can sync everything up, how we can have, like, an Apple computer literally talk to a Mac. You know, a lot of it is an Excel spreadsheet where there's one column missing, you know,
and
then no one can talk to each other, you know. So they have some very interesting ways to do this, but everything goes at a glacial speed.
Well,
you know.
So basically, the way that they do it is, you can't do it federally. You have to do it through state.
You can do it federally, but there's a backdoor kind of way to do it, which is this compact state agreements, which is a way for every state to agree to having a certain way to submit mandated homicide data, and then each state signs on to it. And then after you get like 1/3 or 2/3, I can't remember, of the states to agree to it, then it becomes mandated. It becomes federal.
Right. But it's not going to happen from a federal down.
No.
So there'd have to be a standardization that's agreed to. So you'd have to get the states to do the work to come together on this.
That's what we understand. That seems to be kind of a backdoor way to do this and the easiest way to do it.
And is there interest?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I mean, I've been working with them for the past year. It's, again, very slow going. So they have to get like a certain amount of states to sign on to it. And it's a little bit of like a snowball effect. So once you get a certain amount of states, then another state will sign on. So I'm very hopeful, and I hope that through this series, people will slowly understand that, you know, a lot of our systems are broken, which I had no idea going into this whole thing, that our databases are, you know, extremely broken. So, you know, hopefully some kind of grassroots movement will happen, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, so everybody has the idea that all of our information is being put into supercomputers 24/7, at least on a domestic side. And that's not really happening. Law enforcement is not that good, to be honest.
But it's not really their fault, though, is it? I mean, this is kind of just a mess that happened because we haven't progressed enough, but that comes down to certain people making the right decisions. The average officer on the street, he can't change this.
But you can't let process get in the way of progress. You know, that's the problem.
But it has.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's talk about 9/11 money. Where did 9/11 money go? You know, it went to AP armored personnel carriers instead of training, instead of computer systems or things like that. Yeah. So we have to prioritize. And the problem is, you know, let's face it, if you had a choice between spending 5 hours inputting,
a gun you found on the side of the road.
Right. Versus going to shoot that gun on a Saturday, mm-hmm. you know, the choice that you'd want to make, you know what I'm saying? So, those are the issues at play as well. And sometimes law enforcement agencies need to, not do the fun thing first.
We need to help law enforcement do the best job they can by streamlining what they can do, you know?
Right. The other thing is like, so can the public sector learn from the private sector? Can the private sector donate enough to the public sector so that it becomes easy? So basically, you know, some guy just basically puts this very easy system into place and it allows all these law enforcement agencies to kind of very easily scale up. The question is, are all these law enforcement agencies going to trust each other? Because is the DEA going to use the same database as the ATF, which is going to use the same database as the Portland Police Department, which is going to use the same as the Florida Police Department when, you know, somebody sold the Florida department, a system for accounting, versus somebody sold Portland a different system.
Yeah.
Based on budgets and constraints and stuff like that.
But exactly.
Law enforcement does want to solve crime.
Absolutely.
And they want the best tools to do it. So I don't know, besides budget constraints, what would be the pushback here?
I think
territory, correct?
Territory, yes. It's territorialism.
Yeah.
But I think we're also saying, like, I don't think there's anyone really making those decisions. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not like somebody's sitting in the room saying, yes, we're going to do, you know, and they're thinking about that. I think, you know, again, overworked, underpaid. You know, what they're thinking about is clearance rates and going out and like hitting the streets and interviewing people. They're not thinking about, geez, I wish my computer system, you know, talked better. You know, my column A sunk up with Bob's column C. You know what I'm saying? It's just, you're talking about a lot of bureaucratic problems.
But once you start introducing these ideas into the public arena like you are with this new series, then perhaps you will have people who can make decisions to help further this along. They will take it and run with it, possibly, correct?
Okay, we are, I think we are letting a lot of people have a free pass because guess what? In Canada, it is mandated.
Well, but don't we ignore what Canada does?
We do. We do. Yeah. But guess what? Canada is much better at solving their crime, their murders, than we are. And it's not because there's so few of them. One of the reasons is because they have a fully integrated VICAP system. Mm. They took their VICAP system from our VICAP system. They made it mandatory. And they have like triple the amount of records in the VICAP system. So when you have issues like what we're talking about, we didn't say it earlier, but it's linkage blindness. Mm. When different agencies can't really see a crime, the connections of a crime, they're able to, they have a computer system and an algorithm that's much better at seeing those connections.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if there's – because it's one thing that I know that Rachel said she's working to try and get this moving, but there's nothing more powerful than a series like this. People are visual creatures, so – when they're sitting down to watch the killing season, at some point, maybe it will start to click. Wow, this could be useful. Again, I don't think they're paying any attention to what Canada does.
Duly noted.
So that's just one thing that I wanted to say to you both is that you have this interest in true crime. You're filmmakers. But as you get involved with these things, starts to spur you in different directions, and it's obvious that it takes you much further than just filming the show. It goes beyond the series.
Oh yeah, I mean, we lived it.
Yeah, I mean, we're still living in.
Still living.
We're talking to you. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you that I love the intro song, and I'm glad that we have similar tastes in music.
How did that come about? Tell us about Bauhaus.
That's a great question. You know, I think what was it, like 2 or 3 years ago? We're like, wouldn't it be great if we had that Bela Lugosi song? Yeah, well, that's never going to happen, but wouldn't it be great?
I wanted Bela Lugosi's Dead in a movie since I was 16 years old. And I was like, one day I am going to get Bela Lugosi's Dead in something. Yeah. And I never thought it would have been an A&E show.
Yeah, no. Well, and you know, to give the band credit, they were super open. They really respected what we were doing and were very open. I mean, that song's been in like every single fucking, vampire movie there has been.
Yeah, so I had to write a letter to Peter Murphy, which I was very glad to do, and ask if I can use the song. And, you know, I mean, I was trying to be like, I know this is a vampire song, but I really think that this is really, you know, kind of important to kind of set a vibe for the show, you know, this kind of darkness. And I was a goth kid, and, you know, I've waited years of my life to put that song in something. And then when A&E was like, yes, I was so excited. And I mean, maybe it comes from the hunger, right?
Yeah, hunger, of course.
Meaning the idea of the sex worker.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's in the opening scene. I never actually even thought of it. You know, they're in the golf club. But, man, I said, if nobody sees the show or if the whole show sucks, at least I could show around the credit sequence.
I was sold completely as soon as the show started.
Oh, it's so great to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, the music definitely fits and sets the right tone.
Yeah. And the composer, by the way, Alex Lazarenko, is really amazing. He's the same composer from Cropsey. So we're really excited to use him.
I guess we'll finish up here. Why don't you let the audience know when they can view this great docuseries?
November 12th on A&E. Episode 1 airs at
9 o'clock Eastern.
And then subsequently, it'll be aired the following Saturdays, I think at 9 or at 10. Mm-hmm. And I think we start with one episode, and then it goes to 2, and then it goes to 2. And at the same time, interestingly enough, we'll also be doing a lot of radio, Web Sleuth radio shows during the week to bring in Web Sleuthers to have conversations about what we uncover. So it's really a way for kind of people to be
engaged.
Yeah, and really have a kind of interesting, robust experience where they're, you know, we're talking about Web Sleuths, we're showing it, and then during the week we get to go on Web Sleuths and talk about what we've seen and any new leads that may come up during the week.
So it's almost like the Talking Dead that happens after the Walking Dead, except it's a little more informative.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. We might have to use that one.
For anyone who is in the New York area, we do have a screening at Nighthawk on October 24th, as well as a screening at Brooklyn Law in Brooklyn on the 26th, a sneak peek.
Well, it was great to speak with both of you. And again, it was a great series. I really enjoyed it, especially that first episode. It's the perfect launch for the series, I think.
Well, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. It was great talking to you guys. And it's great to talk to people who understand exactly what we're doing. And it seems like kind of like share some like-minded opinions about this.
Definitely. I was nodding almost all the way through this whole series.
Well, thanks, guys. Much appreciated.
Awesome. Yeah.
Thank you.
Talk to you again.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.